Thank you, Chris. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. Live to your, direct to you from the left-hand seat in the Starlight Lounge. I'm just going to show you the four tax deductions you get as a pilot. You get the big watch, the sunglasses, the pilot's flight case. I notice a few lawyers have been using them recently in Melbourne. And also rubber-soled shoes. These are the only tax deductions you get as an airline captain in Australia. If you want to see me afterwards, if anyone wants to buy some watches or sunglasses. Now, Ian's going to take a photo of me, which is very important for the tax department. Here we go.
Can't see your watch.
That's lovely. Thank you very much. I hope I've covered up Melbourne. He thinks we're actually here in Monaco. Thank you very much for bringing us over to Monaco. Who would have thought racing drivers need a pilot to speak to them from Australia? But what it's like to be a captain? It's fantastic. They give you this button in the flight deck, this tiny little button, and you press the button and it goes, you go, ground cockpit, and there's always someone there who says, go ahead, captain. And you say, there's a bug on my windscreen. And they say, we'll be up in a second, captain. And then a man comes up and he moves you out of your seat and opens the window and dangles precariously. Are there any Boeing pilots here? That's probably a big word for them. Dangles dangerously out the window, just trying to get the bug off the windscreen. And for a second, you actually feel just a little bit guilty that maybe he could plummet to his death. But then you are the captain, and of course, you're expected to be aloof. And of course, if you press the button again, they'll send up another one. I mean, you can't possibly go flying with a dead bug on the windscreen, can you? Really? Yes, and I flew for 20 years as a first officer with some captains like that. And some amazing stories about how self-important they think they are. But it's not that hard, really, to be a pilot. And I'm going to teach a few people before we start talking about Gander and Rodney Rigby and the musical theatre business. I'm going to quickly teach you how to fly. Now, a lot of people don't really know how planes fly, and it's usually our most terrified passengers. They're usually type A behaviours. If you ask their wives, they would say that these people are super control freaks, and they're the ones who usually don't really understand how this airplane gets off the ground. And a 575-tonne A380, 220 tonnes of fuel, and 570 passengers on board, or 545 passengers, 30 crew. Dogs, cats, 26 children unrestrained on knees, and it's a lot of stuff to get airborne. The landing gear weighs 27 tonnes. So when we dangle the Dunlops, and if you live here in the city and you see the Qantas guys stuff it up, I mean, coming over the Yarra Bridge in the morning here, coming into land, if they drop the gear early, they're doing that because they want to slow the plane down. That's 27 tonnes of landing gear. The same weight as 270 passengers. So all these numbers are fairly big, and it's pretty amazing when you have got the thrust under your fingers to make the plane go down the runway. This aeroplane is going on a runway that's 4 kilometres long. It's from Port Melbourne down to St Kilda Pier. That's 4 kilometres. And you get to race down there at about 180 knots, 360 kilometres an hour. You rotate the aeroplane and she just staggers into the sky. It's the most fantastic, exciting feeling. But then she starts speeding up. And towards the end, I'm going to talk about mental health and why we never say that we're very stressed by doing this and that we always pass our simulators without dripping sweat or anything because we're so cool. But I'll get to telling you about Gander. Well, no, first, I'm going to teach you how to fly. This is the wing. The aerofoil shape of the wing is the trick as to how the plane's going to fly. And there are these two air molecules. Bob goes on the bottom, and Tony goes on the top. And Bob and Tony are best friends, and they always go around together, these two air molecules. And when they hit the front of the wing, they say to each other, I'll see you at the back of the wing. And the one goes over the top and one goes over the bottom. And the wing looks like this. Can you see that? And so it's got this curved shape on the top, and on the bottom, it's flat. Thanks, Ian. Tax department's going to love this. Can you see this? I'm going to show you like that. That's the airfoil shape. And so when most people think the wind blows along underneath the wing and pushes the plane up. That's not true. The top molecule goes over the top of the wing, and he gets halfway across and he looks at his watch and says, oh my God, I'm going to have to go much faster to meet Bob because he's on the bottom and we've got to be there at the same time. So as he goes faster, the molecules get further apart and it forms an area of low pressure. And as you'll notice on the TV news, the areas of high pressure and low pressure, the high pressure tries to always even out by going to the low pressure. And what happens is the high pressure pushes up into the low pressure area and the actual wing gets sucked up into the air. I'll show you. If we get it right, you'll see when the molecules suddenly suck the paper up. See that? That was good there. I'll try it again over here. Doesn't often work. That's not good enough. See that? So that's the suction. So when you see those little Cessnas at the airport with the little struts under the wings, they're not holding the wings up. They are trying to stop the wings from falling down. Sorry, from being sucked up in the air. So they're pulling them down. And what we do with big airplanes is we put those BRTs under the wings, you know, the big round things. The 737 MAX has got a few problems with theirs. They put them in front of the wings. But the 737, the big round things under the wings are called the engines, and they weigh a large amount, and they hold the wings down because what the wings want to do is slap over the top of the airplane. So it's just a mathematical trick. We look at the air density, we look at the air pressure, we look at the temperature, and we look at the length of the runway, the size of the wing, which we can modify by using slats and flats, and then the plane's going to jump up into the air when we go to a certain speed down the runway. So there's no magic to it. If you can hang on long enough and get fast enough, the thing will fly. It's very, very simple. And the rest after that is just trying to smoke and mirrors, making people think that it's very exciting. We have these first officers in the right-hand seat, and these days we've got a big cockpit gradient. In the old days, captains were highly revered, and we realised that caused a lot of crashes. It caused the crash of the biggest crash in the world in KLM in Tenerife when two jumbo jets collided, because we had the most experienced KLM captain flying with the most junior first officer, and they were going to take off in fog. And the first officer said to the captain, do you know that Pan Am 747 is on the runway? And this captain didn't take any notice of him. And he went down the runway and crashed into the Pan Am plane. 575 people killed, the world's biggest air disaster. That's because the cockpit gradient was a very, very strong senior captain and a very, very low first officer. So for many years, we've brought that together, so we've had experienced first officers with experienced captains, but unfortunately now we're seeing a problem in the industry where there's a huge amount of expansion and we're putting a lot of paid passengers, cadets in the right-hand seat, and so you've got these guys, people in the right-hand seat who are very inexperienced, and it's very easy to play with their minds and have fun with them. One of the best tricks when you get to the top of climb is you get to the top of climb and you're about to take your headphones off because you've got to leave your headphones on going up and going down. And you're going to take your headphones off and you're just about to take, and they're sitting there with very attentive, and they say, you know, everything says, yes, sir, yes, sir. And you say, listen, stop calling me sir. Yes, sir. I won't call you sir. I promise, sir. You know, and they're so enthusiastic and excited. And you hit the intercom switch just before you take your headphones off and you say these words that you've used back on the ground. And when you're flying, everything is compartmentalised as to what happens at certain times. And when you say goodbye to the engineer, you say this. Thanks a lot. Four good starts. Clear to disconnect. See you on the left-hand side. You say that at top of climb at 35,000 feet. And it's suddenly the guy on the right-hand seat thinks the engineer is still connected to the airplane. 10 kilometres. And your eyes just... It's very scary. So you've actually got to stop having a lend on them too much and try and bring them along and help them with the decision-making. So it's a different industry than it was many years ago. We're racing through, and I've got lots of questions that I need to answer. I know a few over here. Phil's got a great one for you. I just quickly want to talk about Come From Away. Rodney Rigby, I haven't seen you since Crazy For You with Frosty in Sydney. I was going out with one of the actresses, Charmaine Clements. So Rodney and I go way back. Anyway, I got a message to go and see Come From Away, and it was quite embarrassing because I used to work for 3AW radio station, and David Mann was the promotions manager, and he needed a seat filled, and he said, quick, come along to Come From Away. But I started crying in the middle of the show because the pilot, based on a true story, and the lady that you've met, those of you who went to the show, she said what it felt like as a pilot to see your own work implement used as a killing machine. And none of us talk about it, but it really has massively affected us to see the planes go into the towers. Every time I see those planes go into the towers, I don't know how you feel, but I think I feel a bit different to you. It also coincided with the days that Ansett went broke. Thanks, Reg. Reg worked on the Ansett explosion, which let me be stuck in Cairns. So when they got stuck in Newfoundland, I got stuck in Cairns. And the way I came home from there, the only way I came home from there, was because we went out to the airport in our uniforms. Of course, there were no planes, no possible chance of getting out of Cairns. Ansett was gone, and all our passengers were trying to get on Qantas flights. And then there was a lady, catatonic, and one of our cabin crew went over to her and said, you know, what's wrong? And her brother had been in the tower, the West Tower, talking to her on his phone when the tower collapsed and the phone went dead. And she wanted to get to New York. So because of some very lovely Ansett flight attendants, we went and spoke to the administrators, thanks Rich, and they let us use a Flight West aeroplane to get that lady down to Brisbane. But the story that you don't hear about is the fact that our cabin crew couldn't operate that aeroplane, and us pilots, we didn't know how to fly one of those aeroplanes. It wasn't an A320. So two pilots were asked by the administrators to bring that plane down to Brisbane, but there were no cabin crew. And therefore, we couldn't take passengers, and we couldn't go on that aeroplane. So two of the cabin crew who lived in Cairns, who just lost their jobs, offered to come down and fly the plane down to Cairns and operate the aeroplane to get the lady to Brisbane from Cairns, knowing that when we got to Brisbane, there's no way they could get home to Cairns and finish their careers stuck in Brisbane, hoping to get a train to get back in a few weeks' time. It was an amazing time. And at the same time, the people were stuck on the rock. Well, it turned out that a few years later, I ended up flying an A320, a brand new A320 registered in Cayman Islands, to Gander and then on to London to Bahrain for a Saudi sheikh. And on the delivery, I had to land at Gander in a snowstorm. All the other airports nearby went out and we had no fuel left to go anywhere else, so we had to land in the most mother of all snowstorms of my career. It's the most exciting, one of the most exciting landings I've ever done. And you get to Gander and you meet these Newfies. Now, Newfies they're an excuse for a human being. They're about 6'7". And they have these walrus-like moustaches, which I think is in winter to keep the freezing happening, and also in summer to keep out the mosquitoes and the midges. It's a great tourist destination. And they drive big trucks. Everything about them is big, these guys, including big meese. I'm not actually sure what the plural is for moose, but they are huge. If you hit one of these meese while you're driving into town, and this guy said to us, do you mind if we drive down there, we don't take the freeway on the way into town. And I'm thinking, da-da-ding, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. And he goes, the road's a bit slippery. So when a noofy tells you the road's a bit slippery and icy and he doesn't want to drive on it, good idea to take his advice. They looked after us very well. The lady at the front desk says, sorry, there's no more food, we're finished. And obviously the look on my sad little face as I went to my bed. The chef came to my room a few minutes later with enough food and soup on a tray to get me through to the morning. I could probably eat all the time from then till the morning, apologising for the fact that they were closed. They're a special brand of people and they looked after us. But most of all, they look after us in the air. How am I going for timing, Chris? Okay, so the Gander air traffic control system, let me just talk about Gander. Gander's an airport, you've heard about this from Come From Away. It's a rock, it's got funny people on it. And for many years, it was the primary airport that people had to aim for from going east to west against the strong headwinds to refuel aeroplanes. The Britannias, the 707s, it wasn't really until the 747 came along that they could overfly Gander and not have to stop for fuel. But way before that, Gander was a very, very important outpost because we would have probably not won the Second World War if it had not been for Gander and women pilots. Because women pilots ferried the aircraft from America to Europe for the men to fly. And there's 100 dead people, dead pilots, at Gander in the only Commonwealth war grave in the Americas. Because 100 pilots are buried next to Gander Airport. And there's two of them Australians, and I went to the trouble to find their names. I'm sure I did, they're here somewhere. Ron Burrows and Jack Fazell. Now, if you happen to be at the War Memorial on the 5th of August at 11:52 p.m, Jack Fazell's name will be on lights for the War Memorial. And on the 20th of August, Ron Burrows' name for a few minutes will be displayed on the War Memorial in Canberra. So we think about those as pilots every time we fly past. We look down at Gander and we use it for our emergency place to take sick passengers if we have to divert into Gander. But because Noofies can't speak normal languages, because I think they keep their mouths shut like Queenslanders to keep out all these bugs and stuff. You know how those northern Queenslanders, when they speak to you, they go, g'day, good to see you, how are you, fella? It's really good. And David Strassman, that ventriloquist, he comes here every year. Rodney knows they can't send him up there. He doesn't make any money up in Queensland. What's the funny guy with the dunny on his liquor? Why are people phoning Rodney going to say that? Well, Noofies are very similar to that. So they must have absolutely taken hostage a few good English speakers. Because when you speak, when you're dealing with them on air traffic control, which is largely on CPDLC, which is like an SMS system between the pilots and the controllers, they control half the Atlantic. And every now and then they speak to you in pure voice and they speak in a language we can understand. So we just have this idea that they've got some English speakers that they use to translate. But the Noofies look after the pilots. And how many pilots did they look after? Well, it's like this. We have a thing called the NATTRAC, the North Atlantic Track System. To get all the planes from Europe to America and America to Europe, we use 5, now 6 tracks. The tracks are 60 miles wide. So these tracks go all the way from Newfoundland all the way over to Scotland and Ireland. And those tracks are every 1,000 feet, from 29,000 feet to 41,000 feet. There's 6 of them. And we fire planes down them every 10 minutes. And you want to have a look on YouTube. You can check some of this out on the internet. The radar traffic of all these planes going as one lot. And they all go at night time from America, so they land in Europe in the morning, and then in the afternoon they turn around. They choose new tracks, because each day they change the tracks based on the weather conditions and the wind, and then they all fly back again. 2,000 aircraft And the guys in Gander and girls, they handle every single aeroplane. We love Gander. It's on our Christmas card list. And what I found out when I delivered my Shakes A320 was that he and his family were flying to America on that day. And he and his family were diverted into Gander. And he and his family were given three pews in the church where they lived for 4 days. And he loves Gander as much as us. It's just an amazing little story about a little tiny speck on the map. And I suggest you should go and see them. I've only got 2 minutes to go. And I'm going to take some questions now. And I think I've got a great question from Phil.
Okay, so in relation to questions, if you would kindly wait for the mic to be handed to you, and if you could also inform us of your name as well. Thank you.
Hi, Captain James. This is your passenger.
Now, victim.
Mike,
that's my victim speaking, is that right?
My question is this. The situation at the moment, I guess worldwide due to the airline construction, is that it's really duopoly. You've got the Airbus side and you have Boeing on the other. And with the natural attrition, if you like, of aircraft, one has to say to themselves, will Airbus be able to cope if Boeing don't get the 737 MAX into the air sometime shortly? So that's really my question. And I guess given that, you might give us an insight into the 737 MAX. And if we do give them the go-ahead, when will you buy a seat on the plane?
Thank you, Philip. It's a bit of a Dorothy Dixer, because you may have seen me on the ABC and Channel 9 as being the first person in Australia to demand the 737 MAX was grounded. And about 8 hours later, the boss of Shane Carmody, the boss of CASA, did it. And every other regulator around the world followed suit. Quite impressive that Australia took the lead on that. But the 737 MAX issue is a big one. Initially, I thought it was going to be solved very quickly with a computer software fix. That seems to have dragged on. And the worst part is now the FBI is involved. All the witnesses, no doubt, will be pleading the fifth, because no matter who, what sort of work you are doing in your tiny cubicle at Boeing, you have no idea what happened to your work when you handed it to the next person. So it could drag on for a long, long time. It's not really correct to say that it's a duopoly insofar as there's Canadian aircraft. Airbus just bought the Canadian aircraft manufacturer and turned it into another Airbus. There's manufacturers in Brazil and South America. There's also manufacturers in China. They're making an A320 copy in China. And also the Russians have made aircraft. It caught fire and crashed recently. We don't really know why. We think it's a good aeroplane, but unfortunately, it looks like when it got hit by lightning, the Faraday cage effect of the fuselage did not work, and the lightning bolt took the aeroplane out, which eventually crashed and burned in Domodedovo or the other airport in Moscow. So there are other manufacturers. Boeing will get this thing flying. It will probably have to be certified from scratch, which it probably should have been from a long time. The last time this aeroplane was certified was in 1967. This is the time before John and Yoko moved in together. They were going out, but they hadn't moved in together. So what were you doing before John and Yoko moved in together? There are Boeing test pilots who are certifying an aircraft that day. So that aeroplane really needs to be certified, and I think part of this is going to be they're going to certify the aeroplane from scratch, and that may take about a year. Before we go for the next one, I'll do that very quickly. Just want to talk about mental health. Mental health on the ABC on Monday night, they were talking about mental health and particularly burnout. Now, we don't have mental health as pilots because paying $1,230 a month every day of my working life for 31 years, I found out that they don't pay, the insurers don't pay for mental health, for loss of license insurance. so pilots don't have mental health. Next question. Sharish.
With the technological developments in the airline industry, in particular being one of the safest forms of transport, do you have any thoughts on the Mint 370 and why it's still an unsolved mystery?
Thank you. I write a fantastic book about MH370, and I'm donating three of my books to the Rotary to raffle for next month. But MH370, there are a lot of people who have conspiracy theories, but the industry, the actual pilots who fly planes, you know, we have to work out within a few days after a crash what has happened, because it's our lives up there. And you know, this is a really weird industry. I haven't met you for today. But if you're one of my passengers, you come on my plane, and 10 minutes after you come on my plane, I'm prepared to put my life at risk to save yours. And this happens every day. So pilots really have a great sense of importance to their job, and they spend a lot of time studying crashes. And what we think about MH370, most of us, is that they had a smoke, fire, fumes event. The airplane was autopilot disconnect, turned, pointed straight at Penang, and they've been overwhelmed by toxic smoke before they've descended. So I can talk to you for 5 hours about MH370, but what we do know is that when you have a depressurisation, you descend and then turn, but the only thing you turn and descend for is smoke, fire, fumes. And toxic smoke is something that we've stopped having in aircraft since 1980 and 85. The Riyadh and Manchester disasters, and we've fire-blocked all the seats, and we've fire-blocked curtains, and we've fire-blocked the sidewalls, and quite frankly, we've got generations of cabin crew pilots who don't understand what happens if you set fire to a room like this one. This room's not fire-blocked. So I looked in my book, Nightclub Fires, because nightclub fires they happen regularly, and the good part is you get the bodies back, which you don't do with aeroplane crashes. And the last big nightclub fire, we lost 100 kids. 100 people died in 6 minutes from the start of the fire to the end. And 80% of those people, 80% or 80 people, they were not burnt, they weren't trampled on, they weren't bruised. They just breathed in and died. So toxic smoke kills you in about 3 or 4 minutes. And that may be the reason why MH370 happened. And it could happen again tonight. There are approximately 2 pilots in the world who have committed suicide in airliners. We have smoke, fire, fumes event every 2,000 flights. That's 51 times every day. Last question.
David Carruthers. My first experience of an A380 was on a Melbourne to Singapore flight. And when we approached Singapore Airport, we actually did a double take and did a loop round.
A go round.
I wonder just how common
this is. Yeah, it's pretty common. In fact, my record is two go-rounds off the one approach into Los Angeles. Those Americans are so cool. Going around, we practice for this a lot. It's the best thing we do in planes besides the emergency descent. They're our party trick. We practice them a lot in the simulator, and we love doing it because it's the only time that we don't have to worry about spilling the coffee, and safety becomes priority, and we get to fly it like a real pilot. Happens very often.
Thank you very much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're almost at a close today. I would like to express thanks in the usual way that we do to our speakers, to Captain James Nixon. So thank you very much, James.
Thank you.